Welcome to the Voyager Express here. Today, slightly off schedule. I had mentioned elsewhere and in the newsletter that I was going to be reading some primary sources from Reindeer Lake, and I did find some interesting ones, but life has caught up to me and I haven't been able to make the time to read them. There's some cool post reports for the district, but they're kind of untranscribed Hudson's Bay Company archives. It's going to take me a bit of time to read through those. So I think we'll have those on a future episode, but that doesn't mean I'm not giving you anything. So I wanted to have an episode out so people could listen to it on your commute to North American Voyager Council's fall gathering, or NAVC as most of us call it, which is happening over in Wisconsin here next weekend in November. I guess when I'm recording this is October 29th, so NAVC is happening November 3rd through 5th. Is that about right? And I was hoping that I was going to be able to show up and facilitate a book club discussion, but a couple of things have happened. I bought a house in October, so that's been sort of an ordeal of moving and paperwork, and have cut down with a cold from moving, and also we have a funeral to attend to, kind of most importantly. My grandmother-in-law passed away finally is a weird way to put it, but she's 99 years old and pretty sharp for most of that, and yeah. Anyway, so she passed away a while back, and we're having the service at the same weekend as NAVC. So I can't attend NAVC, but hopefully you all can. And I wanted to give you some kind of a document to listen to on your commute and kind of have a impromptu book club meeting. Hopefully you folks that listen will identify yourselves and can hang around and talk about things at your meal or whatever. Anyway, I'll miss y'all and hope you have a good time. So let me introduce the source that I have for you. So maybe this is a source that everyone has read already. I would hope so, I guess, because it's really stellar. I revisit it pretty regularly and find new things every time. So we're going to read a small excerpt from John Tanner's narrative. John Tanner is an interesting figure. There's a very slight amount of debate about how to kind of think of John Tanner. Most people, especially kind of Anishinaabe folks, are pretty happy to call him Ojibwe or Ottawa or Anishinaabe, but there's a reality that he was, you know, he was born white and kind of kidnapped when he was 10 or so. But he lived most of his like formative childhood and young adult life as a Ottawa / Ojibwe / Anishinaabe person, kind of generally speaking, and has a really particular, basically as close as we're going to get to an Anishinaabe journal from somebody who is kind of carrying out the fur trade in the area that so many of us are interested in. I'm going to include a really early chapter. This is just chapter 2 that we're reading. And there's some things I really like about this chapter. We can see how much, you know, when we think about the fur trade and Indigenous people's relationship to it, there's lots of discussion of the various ways that Indigenous folks kind of use trading posts as gathering places, or kind of took advantage of the trade goods and maybe storage and that sort of thing. But there's not a lot of discussion of times when Anishinaabe folks and Indigenous folks in general just used fur traders as taxi services. And it's one of the things I really love about the early days of Tanner's narrative. In chapter 2, he spends some time in Grand Portage and at Isle Royal, which is obviously near and dear to my heart. But he also, Natnokwe, his adopted mother, just kind of throws her stuff on the schooner that the Northwest Company had, and regularly just deposits themselves in canoes. And it's just, I don't know, using fur traders as personal taxi service is not really a thing that often gets discussed. So that's one thing I think to keep in mind as you're reading this or listening to this section. Chapter 2 here is sort of how how he uses the fur trade. Maybe I should backtrack here and give you some context for who John Tanner is or was prior to being kidnapped. John Tanner is a junior. His father, I guess it's weird, he's not a junior, but they say his dad is also named John Tanner. I don't think he was the eldest son, but anyway, John Tanner's father was a minister, a preacher of some sort, and was invited to settle in Cincinnati in kind of the really early days of settling in Cincinnati. But this happened in 1790, and in 1787, the Northwest Ordinance came into existence, which was all about many things, but it was in part kind of stripping native land, right? That whole Ohio, all of Ohio from native folks, but it also established that the Northwest Territory was going to not have slavery. This is how it's often talked about in American history classes. So slavery was not going to be part of the Northwest Ordinance. You couldn't own slaves there. And Tanner's father did own slaves. So rather than settling in Cincinnati proper, or kind of on that side of the river, they settled in Kentucky. So just down from Cincinnati, downriver that is, right across from the Big Miami or the Great Miami River in Kentucky is where Tanner's father kind of set up their household. And, you know, this is very much contested and kind of squatting folks. Like, this is how the Ohio Territory is sort of becomes America, is various American squatters kind of coming in, causing trouble, and the federal government coming in to support them. I think it's easy now to take for granted that what is the United States was going to be the United States, but in the immediate aftermath of the American Revolution, and even before then, there was still, you know, there's some sense that people that are going over the Appalachian Mountains might go independent. A big aspect of the American Revolution even happening was because the British kind of blocked settlement on the western side of the Appalachian Mountains. And what that meant, it didn't mean that people didn't go over there to settle or to kind of squat on tribal territory. It just meant that you couldn't legally do it. So it meant that all the kind of wealthy elites in colonial America and these colonial British colonies that were hoping to gain huge tracts of land following the French and Indian War couldn't obtain them legally, therefore couldn't sell them, couldn't give them to people to kind of increase their prestige. And so from 1763 on, you know, there's a big quarrel to like try to figure out how that happens. So it's interesting. The land that Tanner's family settled on in Kentucky is one of those spots. So kind of shortly following the Proclamation of 1763, there's an attempt by Sir William Johnson and some wealthy colonial elites to buy Kentucky. This is called the Fort Stanwix Treaty, where the Haudenosaunee or the Iroquois kind of sell all this land that isn't really theirs. And the Shawnee and Cherokee and people that called Kentucky home, or at least a hunting ground, kind of complained about it. And ultimately, because of the consequences of Pontiac's War, the British government didn't say, okay, we'll do it. And they didn't ratify this Fort Stanwix Treaty. And then in 1774, kind of the famous Long Hunter, it's been written about in one of Alan Urquhart's book, but Jacob Greathouse essentially massacred a bunch of a Mingo chief, Logan's family. Like, they had a shooting match, and essentially Jacob Greathouse and his band waited for all of the Mingos to empty their guns at the shooting match, and then they started killing everybody. And Chief Logan is one of the few people who was like saying, you know, all these illegal trespassers in our land, we should find a way to cohabitate with them. And so when his family was murdered, he kind of put all of his efforts into getting rid of the these people trespassing on tribal lands. And this was the excuse that Lord Dunmore needed, who was the royal governor of Virginia, to declare war on the native folks of Kentucky. And so Lord Dunmore's War is this attempt from kind of a British royal governor who was actually like an attendant to Bonnie Prince Charlie, supposedly, during the Jacobite Rebellion, side note. But Lord Dunmore declared war and marched into Kentucky and eventually forced a land cession treaty of pretty much all of present-day Kentucky and some other bits of land. A lot of that stuff that was in Fort Stanwix kind of forced this land cession. Again, the British government probably wouldn't have ratified it, but very shortly after this happened, Lord Dunmore wound up fleeing because of the revolution, right? So, and that land just kind of remained part of the colonial and then American property, as how Tanner's family wound up settling there in Kentucky. Anyway, this is kind of the background. There is lots of hostility and violence happening between the people that call Ohio and Kentucky home prior to these land grabs and land cession treaties that are kind of forced at gunpoint. And so it's not a particularly safe spot for anybody. So Tanner is kind of kidnapped in that area, in that environment. And his first couple of years, if you read chapter one, you'll get some pretty funny details about how he came to be kidnapped. But his first couple of years were not great. He was kidnapped by a group of people, some Saginaw Ojibwe, and he seemed like he liked his first adoptive mother, but never cared for his adoptive father. And he doesn't even really call the person who kidnapped him his father at all. Just talks about his adopted mother and her daughter. And after a couple of years of that, Netnokwa, who's a Odawa woman and seemingly pretty important, Tanner regularly refers to her as a principal chief of the Odawa. Anyway, Netnokwa or Netnokwe, I kind of go back and forth between how I pronounce it in the reading. Sorry about that. But anyway, Netnokwe adopts Tanner, and Netnokwe is a really interesting cat. She is married to a Red Lake Ojibwe, or Red River Ojibwe man, Togawewinini, I think is his name. And she is the third wife, or like the most recent wife, but she's also by far the oldest. Like, she is 15 years older, I think he says, than her husband, which is just not the norm, you know, for how we think of multiple wives. Oftentimes, the common narrative of the multiple wives for Ojibwe men is, like, constantly getting younger wives, you know, and this is not the case with Netnokwe. She is the oldest wife and the most recent wife, and clearly become something of a matriarch of the family. So this is where the narrative kind of picks up, as they are kind of having his first couple of seasons with Netnokwe and his new adoptive father, who he does refer to as his father, before they decide to go out to the Red River. Some things to track, I guess, while you're listening. A, the reason I'm saying is, like, what does this account tell us about the role of, like, how do indigenous people use fur traders? Like, what are the different ways they interact with them? I think that's an interesting thing to follow. Something to keep in mind, like, alcohol plays a big part in this narrative, and just, you know, be aware that like, Tanner... hopefully this is kind of well understood for fur trade enthusiasts, but we often have a problem of the sources, right? Where we read a lot of fur traders' journals who complain about the treatment of Native people when they're drinking alcohol. And this is sort of like reading a bartender's journal, right? Because we often really only get like, Native people would often not have alcohol except when the fur trader's there. And there are some details in this. I'm not sure if it shows up in this chapter, but in several points in Tanner's journal. And if you read some stuff written by Doug Burke too, you'll see that, like, alcohol consumption is a seasonal affair. It's rare, but it's often kind of done to excess. And whenever alcohol is around, like, it's a pretty traumatic thing for Tanner. But I think, you know, don't give in to the stereotypes, and just, I'll have a link in the show notes here, but the reality is there's basically no demographic group of non-drinkers larger than Native Americans. Kind of the stereotype of alcohol consumption and Native people kind of misses some greater details. Let me look up the specific quote here. So I'll link to an article talking about it, but it's kind of adapted from a book called All the Real Indians Died Off and 20 Other Myths About Native Americans by Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. And Dina Gilio Whitaker. But the kind of the important details here of to consider, I think the quote that I really like here, if this makes sense. So, like, there's certainly unhealthy approaches and level of drinking at certain times in Tanner's narrative and in fur trade narratives in general. But remember, these are rare experiences. And today, more Natives don't drink than most any other demographic in the United States. So the quote here is, among American Indian males who are middle-aged and older, more completely quit drinking than amongst most other groups of American males. And in virtually every tribal group, a lower proportion of women drink. So the myth about American Indian predisposition to alcoholism is as false as saying that white people are naturally predisposed to alcoholism. To even suggest that Indians are simply more prone to alcohol abuse than non-natives implicitly makes assumptions about the superiority of the dominant white society and thus the inferiority of Native peoples. It ignores a complex array of variables that must be considered in assessing alcohol abuse in Indian country. So just a thing to keep in mind. I know most people that listen to this podcast are in a position of like educating folks about the fur trade, and alcohol is certainly a part of it, but it's a more complex figure, and we should be aware of the kind of present day stereotypes that people have about Native folks. And so there's my little asterisk before launching into this Tanner narrative. So some other questions maybe to think about and things to track, like how does Tanner's relationship change? Like what's his status as a person, as a member of this community? What does he have to do to improve it? What are the things that impresses him? What are the things that like make him angry? I think is an interesting thing to think about when reading through John Tanner. Yeah, and there's just a lot. There's so much going on. So unfortunately, I won't be facilitating a discussion, but there's lots to talk about in Tanner's narrative, and you can read it online. And we might, I'm sure I will actually post another chapter at some point down the line. In the early days of planning sort of the podcast that was supposed to come into existence rather than the Voyager Express was one where I talked more explicitly about Ojibwe stuff, and yeah, I was going to have a lot of Tanner. And my brain was like, I'm just going to read all of Tanner. So that might still happen. It's a really good source for understanding it. It's a little bleak, though. When I worked at Grand Portage and people wanted to know what they should know about Ojibwe history, I was like, oh, just read Tanner. Like, everything you need is in John Tanner's narrative, and then read Alexander Henry the Elder's narrative. And with those two, you're good. And everybody that read Tanner would be like, that was so depressing. So I don't know what that says about our assumptions about life in the fur trade or indigenous folks, but like this is some feast or famine time is sort of the norm that you get from that period. So anyway, check it out, have a listen, and I hope everybody has a good time at NAVC and that this is entertaining as you commute over to Wisconsin for a gathering of some dear friends of mine to chat about the fur trade. Anyway, here is John Tanner's narrative, Chapter 2. The following is a reading from John Tanner's narrative, Chapter 2. Early in the spring, Nanokwe and her husband, with their family, started to go to Mackinac. They left me, as they had done before, at Point St. Ignace, as they would not run the risk of losing me by suffering to be seen at Mackinac. On our return, after we had gone 25 or 30 miles from Point St. Ignace, we were detained by contrary winds at a place called Manakuking, a point running out into the lake. Here we encamped with some other Indians and a party of traders. Pigeons were very numerous in the woods, and the boys of my age and the traders were busy shooting them. I had never killed any game, and indeed had never in my life discharged a gun. My mother had purchased at Mackinac a keg of powder, which, as they thought it a little damp, was here spread out to dry. Taugawenini had a large horseman's pistol, and in finding myself somewhat emboldened by his indulgent manner toward me, I requested permission to go and try to kill some pigeons with the pistol. My request was seconded by Nanokwe, who said, "It is time for our son to begin to learn to be a hunter." Accordingly, my father, as I called Taugawenini, loaded the pistol and gave it to me, saying, "Go, my son, and if you kill anything with this, you shall immediately have a gun and learn to hunt." Since I had been a man, I have been placed in difficult situations, but my anxiety for success was never greater than this, my first essay as a hunter. I had not gone far from camp before I met with pigeons, and some of them alighted in the bushes very near me. I cocked my pistol and raised it to my face, bringing the breech almost in contact with my nose. Having brought the sight to bear upon the pigeon, I pulled the trigger and was in that next instant sensible of a humming noise, like that of a stone sent swiftly through the air. I found the pistol at the distance of some paces behind me, and the pigeon under the tree on which he had been sitting. My face was much bruised and covered with blood. I ran home, carrying my pigeon in triumph. My face was speedily bound up, my pistol exchanged for a fowling piece, and I was accoutred with a powder horn and furnished with shot, and allowed to go out after birds. One of the young Indians went with me to observe my manner of shooting. I killed 3 more pigeons in the course of the afternoon, and did not discharge my gun once without killing. Henceforth, I began to be treated with more consideration, and was allowed to hunt often, and I might become expert. Great part of the summer and autumn passed before we returned to Shabawewegun. When we arrived, we found the Indians suffering very severely from the measles, and as Nonokwe was acquainted with the contagious nature of this disease, she was unwilling to expose her family, but passed immediately through the village, and encamped on the river above. Notwithstanding her precaution, we soon began to fall sick. Of 10 persons belonging to our family, including 2 young wives of Tawagawenini, only Nonokwe and myself escaped an attack of this complaint. Several of them were very sick, and the old woman and myself found it as much as we could do to take care of them. In the village, numbers died, but all our family escaped. As the winter approached, they began to get better, and went, at length, to our wintering ground, at the same place where we had spent the former winter. Here I was set to make marten traps, as the others hunters did. The first day I went out early and spent the whole day returning late at night, having made only 3 traps, whereas in the same time a good hunter would have made 25 or 30. On the following morning I visited my traps and found but 1 marten. Thus I continued to do for some days, but my want of success and my awkwardness exposed me to the ridicule of the young men. At length my father began to pity me, and he said, "My son, I must go out and help you make traps." So he went out and spent a day in making large number of traps, which he gave me, and then I was able to take as many martens as the others. The young men, however, did not forget to tell me, on all occasions, of this assistance I had received from my father. This winter was passed like the preceding, but as I became more and more expert and successful in hunting and trapping, I was no longer required to do the work of the women about the lodge. In the following spring, Nonokwe, as usual, went to Mackinac. She always carried a flag in her canoe, and I was told that whenever she came to Mackinac, she was saluted by a gun from the fort. I was now 13 years old, and in my 13th year. Before we left the village, I heard Nonokwe talk of going to Red River, to the relations of her husband. Many of the Ottawas, when they heard this, determined to go with her. Among others was Wakazi, a chief of the village at Waganakazi, or Labrecroche, and others, in all 6 canoes. Instead of leaving me in this instance in St. Point Ignace, they landed with me in the night among the cedars, not far from the village of Mackinac, and the old woman then took me into town to the house of the French trader, Chevalier, with whom she had sufficient influence to secure my confinement for several days in the cellar. Here I remained, not being allowed to go out at all, but was otherwise well treated. This confinement seemed to be unnecessary, as subsequently, when we were ready to go on our journey, we were detained by headwinds at the point now occupied by the missionaries, when I was suffered to run at large. While we remained here, the Indians began to be drunk. My father, who was drunk, but still able to walk about, spoke to 2 young men who were walking together, and taking hold of the shirt sleeve of one of them, he, without intending to do so, tore it. This young man, whose name was Sukatagan, or Spunkwood, was irritated, and giving my father a rough push, he fell on his back. Sukatagan then took up a large stone and threw it at him, hitting him on the forehead. When I saw this, I became alarmed for my own safety, and as I knew that Mitausagia, an Ojibwe chief, was then on the island with a party going against the whites, and as I had understood, they had sought opportunities to kill me, I thought my situation unsafe. I accordingly made my escape to the woods, where I hid myself for the remainder of the day and the night. On the following day, being pressed by hunger, I returned and secreted myself for some time in the low cedars near our lodge, in order to observe what was passing and to ascertain if I might return. At length I discovered my mother calling me and looking for me through the bushes. I went up to her, and she told me to go in and see my father, who was killed. When I went in, my father said to me, "I am killed." He made me sit down with the other children, and talked much to us. He said, "Now, my children, I have to leave you. I am sorry that I must leave you so poor." He said nothing to us about killing the Indian who had struck him with the stone, as some would have done. He was too good a man to wish to involve his family in the troubles of such a course which would have been brought upon them. The young man who had wounded him remained with us, notwithstanding that Nonokwe told him it would not be safe for him to go to the Red River, where her husband's relatives were numerous and powerful, and disposed to take revenge. When we came to the Sault Ste. Marie, we put all our baggage on board a trader's vessel, which was about to sail to the upper end of Lake Superior, and went on ourselves in our canoes. The winds were light, which enabled us to run faster than the vessel, and we arrived 10 days before it at the portage. When she at last came and anchored out at a little distance from the shore, my father and his 2 sons, Wamagunabu, he who puts on feathers, the eldest, and Kiwaden, the North Wind, went out in a canoe to get the baggage. and jumping down into the hold of the vessel, the younger of these young men fell his knee upon a knot of the rope tied around a bundle of goods and received an injury from which he never recovered. The same night his knee was badly swollen, and on the next day he was not able to go out of the lodge. After about 8 or 10 days, we commenced crossing the Grand Portage. We carried him on our shoulders by fastening a blanket to 2 poles, but he was so sick that we had to stop often, which made us long in passing. We left our canoes at the trading house, and when we came to the other side of the portage, were detained some days to make small canoes. When these were nearly finished, my father sent me, with one of his wives, back to the trading house to bring something which had been forgotten. On our return, we met the 2 boys at some distance, coming to tell me to hasten home, for my father was dying, and he wished to see me before he died. When I came into the lodge, I found that he was indeed dying, and though he could see, he was not able to speak to me. In a few minutes, he ceased to breathe. Beside him lay the gun, which he had taken in his hand a few minutes before to shoot the young man who had wounded him at Mackinac. In the morning, when I left him to go to Portage, he was apparently well. My mother told me it was not until afternoon he began to complain. He then came to the lodge saying, "I am now dying, but since I have to go, this young man who has killed me must go with me. I hope to have lived till I had raised you all to be men, but now I must die and leave you poor and without anyone to provide for you." So saying, he stepped out with the gun in his hand to shoot the young man, who was at this time sitting by the door of his own lodge. Kiwaden, hearing this, began to cry, and addressing his father, said, "My father, if I was well, I could help you to kill this man, and could protect my young brothers from the vengeance of his friends after he is dead. But you see my situation, and that I am about to die. My brothers are young and weak, and we shall be murdered if you kill this man." My father replied, "My son, I love you too well to refuse you anything you request." So saying, he returned, leaned out his gun, and after having said a very few words, inquired for me and directed them to send for me. He expired. The old woman procured a coffin from the traders, and they brought my father's body in a wagon to the trading house on this side of the Grand Portage, where they buried him in the burying ground of the whites. His 2 sons, as well as the young man who killed him, accompanied his body to the portage. This last was near being killed by one of my brothers, but the others prevented him, and he was about to strike. It was but a very short time after my father died that we started our journey to Red River. My brother Kiwaden, we carried on a litter, as we had done before, whenever it was necessary to take him out of the canoe. We had passed 2 carrying places and arrived at the 3rd, called Moose Carrying Place, when he said to us, "I must die here. I cannot go further." So Nanokwe determined to stop here, and the remainder of the party went on. A part of our own family chose to continue on with those going to Red River, so that after they had started, there remained only the old woman and one of the younger wives of Togawaywinini, Wamaganabu, the elder brother, Kiwaden, the 2nd, and myself, the youngest. It was about the middle of summer, for all those small berries were ripe when we stopped here on the borders of Moose Lake, which is of cool and clear water like Lake Superior. It is small and round, and a canoe can be very plainly seen across the widest part of it. We were only 2 of us able to do anything, and being myself very young and without any experience as a hunter, we had apprehension that, being left thus alone, we might soon be in want. We had brought with us one of the nets used about Mackinac, and setting this, the first night, caught about 80 trout and whitefish. After remaining here for some time, we found beavers, of which we killed 6, also some otters and muskrats. We had brought with us some corn and grease, so that with the fish we caught and the game we killed, we lived comfortably. But at the approach of winter, the old woman told us we could not venture to remain there by herself, as the winter would be long and cold, and no people, either whites or Indians, near us. Kiwaden was now so sick and weak that in going back to the portage, we were compelled to move slowly, and when we arrived, the waters were beginning to freeze. He lived but a month or 2 after we arrived. It must have been in the early part, or before the middle of the winter, that he died. The old woman buried him by the side of her husband, and hung on one of her flags at his grave. We now, as the weather became severe, began to grow poor, Wamaganabu and myself being unable to kill as much game as we wanted. He was 17 years of age, and I 13, and game was not plentiful. As the weather became more and more cold, we removed from the trading house and set up our lodge in the woods, that we might get wood easier. Here, my brother and myself had to exert ourselves to the utmost to avoid starving. We used to hunt 2 or 3 days' distance from home and often return with but little meat. We had, on one of our hunting paths, a camp built of cedar boughs in which we had kindled a fire so often that at length it became very dry, and last caught fire as we were lying in it. The cedar had become so dry that it flashed up like powder, but fortunately we escaped with little injury. As we were returning, at still a great distance from home, we attempted to cross a river which was so rapid as never to freeze very sound. Though the weather was so cold that the trees were constantly cracking with the frost, we broke in. I first, and afterwards my brother, and he, in attempting to throw himself down upon the ice, wet himself nearly all over, while I had at first only wet my feet and legs wet. Owing to our hands being benumbed with cold, it was long before we could extricate ourselves from our snowshoes, and we were no sooner out of the water than our moccasins and leggings were frozen stiff. My brother was soon discouraged and said he was willing to die. Our spunkwood had got wet when we fell in, and though we at length reached the shore, as we were unable to raise a fire and our moccasins and clothes were frozen so stiff that we could not travel, I began to think that we must die. But I was not like my Indian brother, willing to sit down and wait patiently for death to come. I kept moving about to the best of my power, while he lay in a dry place by the side of the bank, where the wind had blown away the snow. I at length found some very dry rotten wood, which I used as a substitute for spunk, and was so happy to raise a fire. We then applied ourselves to thaw and dry our moccasins, and when partly dry we put them on, and went to collect fuel for a larger fire than we had before had been able to make. At length, when night came on, we had a comfortable fire and dry clothes, and though we had nothing to eat, we did not regard this, after the more severe suffering from cold. At the earliest dawn, we left our camp and proceeded towards home, but at no great distance met our mother, bringing dry clothes and a little food. She knew that we ought to have come on the preceding day by sunset, and was also aware of the difficult river we had to cross. Soon after dark, being convinced that we must have fallen through the ice, she started, and walking all night, met us not far from the place where the accident happened. Thus we lived for some time, in a suffering and almost starving condition, when a Muskego, or swamp Indian, called the Smoker, came to the trading house and learned that we were very poor, invited us home with him to his own country, saying he could hunt for us and would bring us back in the spring. We went 2 long days' journey towards the west and came to a place called Wasakatasisibi, or Burntwood River, where we found his lodge. He took us into his own lodge, and while we remained with him, we wanted for nothing. Such is still the custom of the Indians remote from the whites, but the Ottawas and those near the settlements have learned to be like the whites, and to give only to those who can pay. If anyone, who had at that time been of the family of Nonokwe, were now, after so many years, to meet one of the family of Petwawe Winini, we would call him brother, and treat him as such. We had been but a few days at the portage when another man of the same band of Muskegos invited us to go with him to a large island on Lake Superior, where, he said, were plenty of caribou and sturgeon, and where, he had no doubt, he could provide all that would be necessary for our support. We went with him accordingly, and starting at the earliest appearance of dawn, we reached the island somewhat before night, though there was a light wind ahead. In the low rocky points about the island, we found more gulls' eggs than we were able to take away. We also took, with spears, 2 or 3 sturgeons immediately on our arrival, so that our want of food was supplied. On the next day, Wagamawab, whom we called our brother-in-law, and who was, in some remote degree, related to Nonokwa, went to hunt, and returned at evening, having killed 2 caribou. On this island is a large lake, which took us about a day to reach from the shore, and into the lake runs a small river. Here we found beaver, otter, and other game, and as long as we remained in the island, we had an abundant supply of provisions. We met here the relations of Wagamawab in 8 canoes, with whom we at length started to return to the portage. We were 10 canoes in all, and we started, as we had done in coming, at the earliest dawn of the morning. The night had been calm, and the water, when we left the island, was perfectly smooth. We proceeded about 200 yards into the lake, when the canoes all stopped together, and the chief, in a very loud voice, addressed a prayer to the Great Spirit, entreating him to give us a good look to cross the lake. "You," said he, "have made this lake, and you have made us, your children. You can now cause that the water shall remain smooth while we pass over in safety." In this manner he continued praying for 5 or 10 minutes. He then threw into the lake a small quantity of tobacco, in which each of the canoes followed his example. They then all started together, and the old chief commenced his song, which was a religious one, but I can't not remember exactly what the meaning of what he sung. I had now forgotten my mother tongue and retained few, if any, ideas of the religion of the whites, and I can remember that this address of the chief to the Great Spirit appeared to me impressive and solemn, and the Indians seemed all somewhat impressed by it, or perhaps by their situation, being exposed on the broad lake in their frail bark canoes. They could not but feel their dependence upon the power which controls the winds and waves. They rowed and paddled silently and diligently, and long before night arrived in safety at the Grand Portage, the lake having remained perfectly calm. At this time, I was suffered to go entirely at large, being subjected to no manner of restraint, and might, at almost any time, have made my escape from the Indians. But I believed my father and all my friends had been murdered, and I remembered the laborious and confined manner in which I must live if I returned among the whites, where, having no friends and being destitute of money or property, I must, of necessity, be exposed to all the ills of extreme poverty. Among the Indians I saw that those who were too young or too weak to hunt for themselves were sure to find someone to provide for them. I was also rising in the estimation of the Indians and becoming as one of them. I therefore chose, for the present, to remain with them, but always intended at some future time to return and live among the whites. We were now again at the portage, whence we had been twice removed by the friendly hospitality of the Muskegos, and were left to consult about the course we would pursue. When our mother had at length made up her mind to continue on to the Red River, according to her original plan, she heard by one of the traders that her son-in-law, the husband of one of her daughters, who had continued on from Moose Lake, at that time we had been compelled to stop with Keewaydin, had been killed by an old man in a drunken frolic. The traders had brought the widow as far as Rainy Lake, hence she had sent word to her mother that she wished her to come and join her. This was an additional inducement to us to go to the Red River, and we determined to proceed without delay. Our canoe had been lent to the traders, which was sent to the route towards Red River to bring packs. As they were about to dispatch more canoes, Nanokwe requested they would distribute us about, one or two to each canoe, so that we might go on until we should meet our own canoe. After a day or two, we met the Frenchmen with our canoe, but as they refused to give it up, the old woman took it from them without their consent, put it in the water, and put our baggage on board. The Frenchmen dared not make any resistance. I have never met with an Indian, either man or woman, who had so much authority as Aunt Nokwe. She could accomplish whatever she pleased, either with the traders or the Indians, probably in some measure because she never attempted to do anything which was not right or just. At Rainy Lake, we found the old woman's daughter, in the care of some Indians, but very poor. Nanokwe conferred long with her on our situation. She talked of all of our misfortunes and losses and the death of her husband and son. She knew, she said, that her two little sons who remained were young, but they were now becoming able to do something, and that since she had come so far for the purpose of going to the Red River to hunt beaver, she was not willing to turn back. My brother and myself, although deeply interested in these consultations, were not allowed to have any voice. It being determined that we should go to the Red River, we continued on to the Lake of the Woods. This lake is called by the Indians Pobequa Wanagasaga Igun, Lake of the Sand Hills. Why it is called Lake of the Woods by the whites I cannot tell, as there is not much wood about it. Here we were much endangered by high winds and waves dashing into our canoe so fast that I was scarcely able, with a large kettle, to throw out the water as fast as it came in. In the fall of the year we arrived at the Lake of Dirty Water, called by the whites Lake Winnipeg. Here old Nanokwa, being much cast down with grief in consequence of all the misfortunes and losses she had encountered since she left her own country, began to drink, which was unusual with her, and soon became drunk. We, being foolish and unaccustomed to direct our own motions, seeing that the wind rose fair, determined to place the old woman in the canoe and cross to the other side of the lake. Traders advised us not to attempt it, in the present state of the wind, but we would not listen to them, and accordingly pushed off and raised our sail. As the wind blew directly off the shore, the waves did not there run high, but we had only been out for a short time when they began to dash with great violence into the canoe. We now found that it would be more dangerous to attempt to turn about and regain the shore than we had left, than to continue on directly before the wind. At this time, the sun went down, and the wind began to blow more violently. We looked upon ourselves as lost and began to cry. At this time, the old woman began to wake from her drunken fit, and presently, becoming conscious of our situation, she sprang up, and first addressing a loud and earnest prayer to the Great Spirit, she applied herself, with surprising activity, to the use of her paddle, and at the same time encouraging us and directing Wambegon and Pew how to steer the canoe. But at length, as we came near the shore, and she began to recognize the spot we were approaching, she also began to manifest much alarm, and said to us, "My children, it appears that we must all perish, for this shore before us is full of large rocks lying in the water, and our canoe must be dashed to pieces. Nevertheless, we can do nothing but to run directly on, and though we cannot see where the rocks are, we may possibly pass between them." And so it happened. Our canoe being thrown high upon a spot of smooth sand beach where it first struck, we immediately sprang out and soon dragged it up beyond the reach of the waves. We encamped and had no sooner kindled the fire than we began to laugh at the old woman for being drunk and for the apprehension she had manifested after she waked. In the morning, we perceived that the shore was such as she had described, and that in utter darkness we had landed where, with such a wind, the boldest Indian would not venture by daylight. We remained at this camp great part of the next day, which happened to be calm and fair, to dry our baggage, and towards evening embarked and ran for the mouth of the Red River. We did not enter the mouth of the river until late at night, and perceiving a lodge, we landed and laid down without kindling a fire or making any noise to disturb the people, as we did not know who they were. In the morning, they came to us, came and waked us, and we found them to be the family of one of the brothers of Taugaweewinini, and the very people we had come to seek.